Well, the first thing is welcome. Thank you for coming. Just to be clear, this is the tutorial on Introduction to Bayesian Inference with JAGS. So if you didn't sign up for this one or you don't want to be in this one, now is a good time to discreetly leave. For everybody else, thank you very much for coming. Now, today's tutorial will last all morning. Somebody already asked me about this, so there's one tutorial running from now until 1 o'clock, and we have a 30-minute coffee break at 11. Now, I have to say I've never given a pre-conference tutorial on JAGS before. I do have plenty of material to teach JAGS, but I've never taught in this format. So I wasn't really sure what to do. So basically what I decided to do was just take everything that I had from my two-day course on JAGS and just dip into it selectively. So I hope you don't mind this approach. It does mean I can be a little bit more flexible depending on what you guys want to talk about, but I've made a selection of the teaching material that I hope will fit into the time slot this morning, but we'll just have to, just to see if it works well or not. Second thing is that I realized on the train on the way to Brussels that I'd come away with the wrong version of my slides, but fortunately I was able to pull down an older version of my slides from my Google Drive, but they've all got the wrong date on them. They all say Zurich 2006, so I'm sorry about that, but it's not just laziness, it's the fact that I made that slight mistake. But fortunately, I'm able to present some slides, otherwise I would be in trouble. I'd have to just do an interpretive dance or something like that instead of presenting slides. So, let's get started. Are there any questions before we get started, by the way? Let's just... No, all right then. Well, I'll say something about myself. My name's Martin Plummer. I am a member of the R Core team, and I'm co-president of the R Foundation. But on top of my work on R, I also work on this thing called JAGS. JAGS is software for Bayesian inference. One of many available software packages that are out there for Bayesian inference, particularly the ones using Markov chain Monte Carlo. It's actually quite a competitive field. And to start with, I need to acknowledge the inspiration for JAGS and explain where it came from. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about Bayesian inference because I think that the starting point for this tutorial should be somewhat beyond that. So I hope you've at least been exposed to ideas of Bayesian inference and what it means. But if you're not, if you're really confused by that, then now would be a good time to say. Okay, I think we're okay. So I mean, I'll just get straight into it to describe what JAGS is and where it came from. So back in the early 1990s, I worked in Cambridge in the Medical Research Council Biostatistics Unit, where they were, at that time, developing a software package called BUGS. And BUGS stands for Bayesian Inference Using Gibbs Sampling. Gibbs sampling was, at that time, a new technology that had released Bayesian inference from the constraints of analyzing models that could be solved analytically, and allowed a numerical solution to Bayesian inference. And BUGS was actually quite revolutionary because it combined three different ideas. Well, the first one is Bayesian inference. The second one is graphical modeling. And the third one is the idea of simulation-based inference. And it's point three that I really want to start on this morning. And it did all of those things while at the same time providing some user-friendly software as well. And it's no exaggeration to say that the BUGS project has helped to really popularize Bayesian methods, which previously had limited applicability, because you could only look at problems where you could find an analytic solution. So the design of bugs is actually, according to David Spiegelhalter, who's the driving force behind it, is actually based on developments in artificial intelligence in the 1980s. And one of the key principles that people working in AI at that time came up with was the idea that there's actually two different aspects to inference. One is the knowledge base, and the other one is the inference engine. So they decided the knowledge base should be represented in a declarative form, which, quote, expresses local relationships between entities. So you can take a very, very complicated system, and you could break it down into local relationships. And this is really one of the powerful ideas behind graphical modeling. So the knowledge base is represented by a directed acyclic graph. And I'll come on to that a little bit later. Whereas the uncertainty is represented by a probability distribution on that graph. So the kind of problems that bugs are suitable for is basically what they call modeling complexity. So you might start off with a standard statistical model, some kind of regression model, for example, that you know how to analyze with standard software, but there might be additional problems with it. So you might have nested or crossed random effects, missing data, measurement error. You might have informative censoring, data that are missing might actually be informative. And there, of course, you have complex responses such as ordinal outcomes and ranks and so on. So this morning, I'd like to give a demonstration of how you can use ranking as an outcome in Bayesian modeling. Now, what happened in the mid-1990s was that bugs became win bugs. Now, at this point, I'd left Cambridge and I'd gone to work at the International Agency for Research on Cancer in France, where I remain to this day. I must be honest and say that I never participated in the bugs project when I was in Cambridge. But they made this decision in the mid-1990s to become win bugs. So the software was rewritten in Component Pascal. That's one of these languages from the Niklaus Wirth stable. And the key thing about it was it ran on Windows only, hence the name WinBugs. And the scripting language, which bugs used to have, was replaced by a point-and-click interface, although they later reintroduced a new scripting language. Now, to me, these were all fairly regressive ideas. Linux was around and rapidly gaining momentum. So the idea of writing a Windows-specific software and also the idea of getting rid of a scripting interface, I didn't like it. So that was my idea for developing JAGS. So it's just another Gibbs sampler. It's obviously a play on words on the original name of bug. So it's a clone. It's designed to do the same thing. It's cross-platform. It runs on all the major computing platforms. And it has an interface to R. In fact, it now has several interfaces to R, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit this morning. So the idea is it's more or less compatible with bugs, and in particular, models are described in the same way using the bugs language. So from now on, when I talk about bugs, I'm not talking about the software, I'm talking about the language. So the first one's not so... these are a couple of references on Bayesian inference if you're interested in that kind of thing. I'll circulate the slides from the talk afterwards, so you don't need to take notes. There's a popular book explaining Bayesian inference to a general audience by Sharon McGrain called The Theory That Would Not Die. It's a bit of a hyperbolic title, but it's an interesting story. As you can see, it says Zurich, April 2016. Sorry about that. I'd like to leap into the idea of inference using sampling, because I think this is really one of the most powerful ideas behind MCMC and other related methods. Now, just who here was intending to follow the course on a laptop? As I said, I've never given a tutorial before, so I wasn't really sure what the format is. Okay, so I'll give a little talk here, and then we'll have an exercise. I did distribute a practicals document, which I hope you've printed, those of you that want to follow along, but we'll spend a little bit of time on a demonstration, and then I'll carry on with a live demonstration of the software. So the basic idea of sampling based inference is that we can draw samples from the distribution of a random variable. So theta here is some parameter in the model that we're interested in. It could be anything. It could be a regression parameter or a variance or anything indeed. And suppose we can draw samples from the distribution. Then however we want to summarize that, if we've got some function of those parameters, then we can estimate the mean of that function by just simply taking the empirical average, the empirical mean, of the samples suitably transformed. And as the number of samples n increases, we know that that converges to the expectation that we're looking for. Furthermore, if our function here has certain regularity conditions, if it has a finite variance, then the central limit theorem applies. What that means is that the sample mean has a normal distribution with a standard error that shrinks as the inverse square root of the number of samples. So since the number of samples is within our control, we can generate as many samples as we like. That means that we can get an approximation that is as accurate as we like to the posterior distribution. Now, in practice, it takes time to generate these samples, and often the number that we can generate is limited by the size of the problem and the speed of the Markov chain Monte Carlo, but I'll come back to that later. So just about anything that we might be interested in to summarize a posterior distribution can be expressed in the form of expectation. So this applies to everything. There's the expectation of the parameter itself, its variance, its distribution function, and once you've got that, you can invert that to get quantiles. So even quantiles can be expressed in terms of expectations and so on. So, but one of the most powerful ideas is, well, imagine that our parameter theta is multidimensional, and if we're only interested in one dimension of that, then that's really a special case of this general situation. Theta I, element I of vector theta, is just some function of theta as well. So what that means is we just throw away everything we're not interested in and just analyze the marginal distribution of the parameters that we are interested in. And that is incredibly liberating because it completely solves the problem of nuisance parameters. You just ignore them. And that's an incredibly powerful idea. So in order to, when I set up the R interface to JAGS, I thought a little bit about, well, how are models represented in R in general, and how can I create something that's analogous to that for JAGS? Other people had different ideas, and I'll demonstrate that later, but here's the basic idea. So everybody's familiar with the GLM function for fitting generalized linear models. And if you break it down, when you fit a GLM, there's three components to it. First of all, there's a description of the model. And for a GLM, that comes in two parts. There's a model formula plus the family, and optionally the link function. So that's the description of the model. The second part is the data set. You can either provide data directly, or if you don't, the variables are taken from the calling environment. And a third component, which is often overlooked, is initial values for the parameters. And the reason it's often overlooked is that the most model fitting software that we use is so good, it doesn't need you to supply missing values. You can optionally, not missing values, starting values for your parameters. You can optionally supply initial values, and if you're fitting a GLM with a slightly odd combination of family and link function, you might even need to do that. But on the whole, you don't need to do it because the software chooses it for you. However, as we shall see, when you're doing Bayesian inference, initial values are more or less always required. So what that does is that creates a model object, and then there are various extractor functions that you can use, apply to that fitted model object to extract what you need. So most of the time we want a summary of the fitted model. You can extract the regression coefficients, the covariance matrix, confidence intervals, and so on. And you can do further things on it, like predict and so on. And all of these functions are generic. So if you come up with some new class of models and a function that fits them, then you can supply methods for your new model class that do all of these things. So that's the basic design template. So I tried to follow that for fitting models in JAGS. So when you fit a model in JAGS, it starts with the same basic idea. So the function is called JAGS.model, and the components are, there's a string there, blocker.bug, which is the name of a file, and the file contains a description of the model in the bug's language. So there are other ways of representing models within R itself, and I can talk about that later. Then there's the data. The data is a named list of data for the variables that are observed in the model. Inits is the initial values. And the last one is the number of chains, because you can run the simulation several times. And in fact, it's advisable to do that. And towards the end of this morning, I'll talk about issues of convergence and running multiple chains and so on. Now, the difference between JAGS.model and GLM is that what is returned by that, this object that I've assigned to M, is not really a fitted model. It's actually a dynamic object, but the dynamic object can be queried to generate samples from the posterior. So let's look at a very, very simple location scale model. Actually, I should be doing that, shouldn't I, to make my slides as big as possible. Sorry about that. So suppose we have some observations y1 up to yn, and we assume that they're all independent and identically distributed. There are normal random variables with a known variance of 1, but an unknown location theta. So to represent that model in the bug's language, you would use this. Now you're looking at that and you say, well, that looks exactly like R. And you're quite right, because the bug's language was inspired by S, the S language. And so syntactically, it looks a lot like S, but it's not. And I'll come on to some of the differences later. So basically, you have a for loop there, and you're looping over the elements of the vector y, and you're saying for each element that has a normal distribution with mean theta and variance 1. Sure, what I'm trying to say here. Right, so we're being Bayesian. So we can't, that's not a complete description of the model. So in Bayesian inference, you have to give a prior distribution to the parameter theta itself. So that might be an example of how you give a prior. So it's a normal distribution with mean 0. And here, I have to say there's an extra complexity of the bug's language, which is that it parameterizes the normal distribution and many other distributions in terms of the mean and the precision, where the precision in this case is 1 over the variance. And I'll explain why that is in a demonstration in a minute. So to say the prior distribution of my unknown parameter theta is mean 0 and standard deviation 100, you use this formulation here using engineering notation to say that this has very low precision. So you've got to remember that in the bug's language, the normal distribution is parameterized in terms of its precision, not in terms of its variance or standard error. Otherwise, you'll get the wrong answer. So this kind of thing is very, very common in bug's code. It's the normal kind of thing to represent this as a sort of a diffuse prior distribution. So putting those things together, we have a complete minimal model in the bug's language. And what that looks like is that there's a keyword model and curly brackets. And within curly brackets, we have what are called relations that define the model. So we have the for loop containing the relations that define the observed value y. And at the bottom, we have another relation that determines the prior distribution for unknown parameter theta. So I think, no, there's one more step. So having created the model file and having called the jags.model function to create this model M, you can then use this sample that will generate this function, that will generate samples from the posterior distribution of the parameter theta. So it's called coder.samples. The first argument is the model, and then you have to give a character vector of the variables that you want to sample, that you want results from, and the number of iterations that you want to run. And that returns an object of class MCMCList. But for the first exercise, I think we are not really interested in what an MCMCList looks like. We're just interested in the idea that we've got a bag of samples from the posterior. So the first exercise is based on that idea. Right. So those of you that are following were on your laptop, so we'll do a quick exercise two, bag of samples, and for those of you that are not following, I could just do it on the screen if you like. That's probably the easiest way to do it. So I've got this R markdown document that's got all the exercises and the solutions in, and I've already distributed a copy of that, actually, for those of you that registered and got the message about all the material from the course. You should already have access to that. So let's I would like some people to follow along with this, actually. So the first thing to do is to set the seed, and I would like everybody to use the same seed, because that will reinforce an important point in a minute. So I'm using seed 1335 for R and generating some data. It's just a vector of length 50. And with this simulated data, the true mean is 3.7. So let's... Yep. It's quite complicated to set JAGS up, because you have to download and install the JAGS software. You have that working. How can I share this in an easy way? I could put it on a Google Drive, but then the URL is incredibly long and complicated, isn't it? So, what have you got any suggestions? Yeah. Okay then. All right. I'll take 5 minutes to put that up on Google Drive, and then you can advise me on how to give you a really short URL so that you can access it. Well, that's not good. Let's see if we're still connected to the Wi-Fi. Yes, we are. Well, that's unfortunate. Let's try again. Can anybody else connect to Google, or is it just me? Well, in the limo, I can use my phone. And use it as a... Thank you. just try disconnecting and reconnecting. Oh, no, here we go. Right, let's try that again. Create a new folder. Share the folder. Any ideas? There we go. Share. Oh, apparently I'm offline again. It's crashed. So how do I shorten this? This is far too long. .com? See that one? I'll open that in a new window, and then I'll upload the practicals document. Yeah, I'll put the slides in there as well. That's why I created a directory, so I can just dump everything in there. Come on, I'm not offline, I'm online. You want them as handouts? It's probably easier. All right, that's your destination. I'll try and make that a bit bigger for you. Oh, hello. There we go. Right, let me know if you can't access that. Doesn't work? It does work. Cool. I'll just leave that up there for a minute so that everybody can. actually need the practicals folder as well. Which I already distributed as a zip file. So okay, I'm going to have to go into my email, and for security reasons, I'm going to take you, not show you my email. Right, I'm back. So there's three files now in that shared folder. There's the PDF, prax.pdf, there's the slide handouts, and there's a zip file which contains the files you need to actually run the practicals. So do download that. So that's already an important learning experience for me. Always have a backup download available for people. So there's a lot of material, introduction material on Bayesian inference there in the document, but this is where you want to start. This exercise introduces the RJAX package by a very simple Bayesian location model. So first of all, we generate 50 independent samples from a normal distribution, where because it's simulated, we can set the true value. The true value of the mean is 3.7, and the standard deviation is 1. And I would like everybody to use the same seed. Make sure it's actually the same seed I'm using myself. 1355. So everybody generates the same data. And then there's a file that's in that zip file that I've just given you called location1.bug. And that contains this very, very simple model, the one that was on my slides, that just shows what a very simple location scale model looks like in the bugs language. To fit this model, you have to first of all start by loading the RJAX package. And then you fit the model using the JAGS.model function, where the first argument is the name of the file that contains the model. Now, if you're using RStudio, I recommend you actually open up that file and have a look at it and check its contents and make sure it is what corresponds to the model I just gave you. In this example, I'm assuming that it's in the working directory, so please set your working directory accordingly inside the folder where all you've got your practicals. And The data required by this, and I'll recap this in a minute. The data required by this model is the vector y of observations and a scalar value n, which is the length of that vector. So, because this is a very simple model and the data is very, 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 very small, that should fit instantly and give you this model object M of class Jenks, and you can check that by using the class function and then print it, see what it looks like. And you can also extract things from this model. So it's got these built-in extractor functions. So we're using sort of object-oriented style here. M$data will return the data that's in the model. And there's other similar functions. And the key thing here, to get samples from your model, you want to use this coder.samples function to get samples of the parameter theta and run the model for 1,000 iterations. And to do the exercise, the last thing you need to do is to use the unlist function just to convert this thing into just a vector, okay? Because at the moment, we're not interested in the structure of this object. We're just interested in the idea that this is what we've got. So here's some exercises. I give you 10 minutes to work through that. Calculate the sample mean. Estimate the standard error of the sample mean. Work out how many samples you need. You would need to estimate the sample mean to within 2 decimal places. Plot the posterior density and verify that the samples you've got are from a normal distribution, either informally using a QQ plot or formally using a Shapiro-Wilk test. So I'll give you 10 minutes to work through that, and then I'll do a demonstration. And those of you who are not following on the computer, fine. I'll do it myself in a minute, so you'll see what it looks like. Stick your hand up if you have any trouble, because I'm here to help. While you're doing that, I'll actually upload my R Markdown solutions file to the same folder. Well, I'll show you. I'm using the extension .bug, but it's just a text file. So using RStudio will open it up as a text file. Is it okay? Yeah, no, the extension .bug is completely arbitrary. You can use .txt so that it will open up in a text editor. Some people prefer to do that. .r will also also work, obviously, but then that's a bit confusing because it's technically it's not our code. Okay, I've also uploaded the solutions file. It's an R Markdown file. So I'll go through that in a minute. I'll give you another 5 minutes to do the exercises. For the URL, yeah. It's here, highlighted. 2 minutes, and then I'll give the demonstration. So I'm now going to step through the exercises there. Hopefully some of you managed to get through this, at least get some samples and estimates out. So we start by generating the data. Just print that there to convince everybody that's what we got. So it's a random sample from the normal distribution. Load the RJAX package. As you can see, it gives you a little bit of information here. It's the RJAX package depends on CODA. CODA is the package that's concerned with diagnostics. Markov chain Monte Carlo, and I'll talk about that after the coffee break. It tells you which version of JAGS it's linking to, version 4.2.0, and it tells you which modules are loaded. JAGS modules are like R packages. Loading a module changes the functionality of JAGS. So let's create a model object. As you can see, pretty quick. Gives us lots of information about what it's doing. That information is more useful when you have a bigger model. Unless anybody has any particular questions about that, I'll just skip straight onto it. I'm just going to make this slightly bigger here. So this object we've created is of class JAGS. When you print it, what you get is the text representation of the model, which is nice. It's a nice reminder of what went in it. And that's been annotated at the bottom with the fact that variables N and Y are fully observed in this model. Because in the bug's language, it's not immediately clear which parameters, what are parameters and what are data in the model. But I'll talk about that a bit later. The model also contains a copy of the observed data, just as a GLM object contains the model frame and so on. So you can recover the data that we pass to it from the model object. There it is again. So the model object on itself doesn't represent a fitted model, but we can use it to generate samples. Now this thing under here, that's a progress bar, but because this is a trivial model, it just appeared instantly. In bigger models, it's a useful thing to have because MCMC tends to run quite slowly. And then, as I say, I'm not really interested in the structure of the samples just now. I'm just going to use unlist to turn that just into into a vector of length 1,000 that we can then summarize. So the first thing we want to know is what is the mean. So for me, the mean is 3.685891. Now, who got that answer? Yeah, I bet nobody got that answer. So we took care to set the seed for before for generating the data, but everybody that fitted this model will get a different set of samples. And the reason for that is that JAGS has its own random number generators and its own seeds. So I'll tell you in a moment how to set them for reproducibility. But it's important to remember that JAGS is actually a separate bit of software, and that setting the seed in R does not make your analyses reproducible. So the standard error of the mean, for me, is 0.0044. That's below target, actually, so that's actually fine. If we round down our summary to two decimal places, then we get 3.69. So everybody should have 3.69 when it's rounded, right? More or less. Then there might be one or two exceptions, but that should be the answer. And just the formal calculation for deciding how many samples we need to estimate the sample mean to two decimal places is we only need 804. So we're above target. So as I said earlier, when you're doing MCMC, in principle, you can generate as many samples as you need. The number that you need in practice really depends on what your target for accuracy of estimation is. In this case, it was very simple to achieve. In other models, it might be more complicated. But you can do more than this. There's also plotting the density function. Well, I mean, just do a histogram of it, first of all. You can create a histogram. But because this is a continuous distribution, it also makes sense to plot the density function. Just zoom in on that. So, well, it doesn't look like your classic bell shape. For me, it doesn't, anyway. But let's have a look about how this is a representation of the posterior distribution. See how that compares with... So that's the sample mean. Is that the sample mean? Yes, that's the sample mean of our observations. And recall that we actually generated these data with a true mean of 3.7. So there. So it's certainly true that the posterior distribution includes the true value within its the area of high posterior probability. So that's good. But there's also considerable uncertainty because we've only observed 50 observations, and that's not really enough to accurately estimate the results. So I'm not actually sure what this is going to produce for me, but that looks pretty good. So the QQ plot looks pretty straight, and you can formalize that with a Shapiro-Wilk test just to say that p-value 0.4266, that means there's no evidence against normality. So that's good because theory predicts that in this simple model the posterior distribution is normal, and the samples being generated from JAGS are passing the test. So you can follow this next part yourself in your own time, and I'm just going to give a demonstration of how to make the run reproducible. So as I said earlier, the initial values can be supplied to JAGS, and the initial values can contain not just the initial values for the parameters, but also the initial values for the random number generator. And that has two parts. First of all, there's the name of the random number generator, and then there's the seed. So here I'm running two chains, both with the Wichmann Hill generator, but with different seeds for the two different chains, here and here. Okay, so I'm going to fit the model twice. In this call, I'm going to run two parallel chains, and the initial values I'm going to supply are init1 for chain 1 and init2 for chain 2. And that's going to make sure that the initial values of the random number generator are fixed. I'm not actually supplying initial values for the parameter theta because this is set deterministically by JAX. So that will be the same. And then we're going to do it again. So MA and MB are two calls that are identical, both using the same set of initial values. And hopefully I will be able to demonstrate that this will give you a reproducible result. Oh, I need to go back up here. So I've defined my initial values there, calling JAX with the initial value set, doing exactly the same thing. So there's a, that's not going to work. There's a state function that gives you the state of the parameters of the model, and that has an optional argument internal, and if you set that to true, it also gives you the state of the random number generator. So let me just call it by default. So MA state. That tells me that in both chains, the theta has been initialized to the value 0. But if I call it with internal equals true, it's also going to give me the state of the random number generator here. There's the name of it, and there's the state of it. And the state is a numeric vector, an integer vector. Now, if I do that same thing for model B, should get the same result. Let me just expand that. Okay, so the internal state of model A and model B is the same, the parameters and the state of the random number generator, and that means that if I run these two models, I will get the same answer. So there's quite a lot of work involved in setting up a JAGS model to make it reproducible, and I'm sorry about that, and it's something that I will try and address in a future version, but it can be done. Now I'm going to continue just with an online demonstration here because I need to compress a lot of material into this tutorial. So I'm now going to talk about this phenomenon called shrinkage. There's a second version of the location model, which I'll just open up there. In this version here, there's a new parameter tau. If I compare that with the first model, in the first model, I set the precision of the prior distribution. In this version here, that's actually a parameter. It's not a parameter I'm going to estimate. It's a parameter that we're going to set by supplying it with the data. So here, in this version, I'm supplying yn and tau. And tau, if I supply that with the data, that means that value is going to be fixed. That value is going to be fixed. And if I fix it to the value 1, it's going to be exactly the same as this model. So I'm going to start off fitting the same model with the prior precision of 1. And I'm going to run it for somewhat longer. I'm going to run it for a million iterations. And then I'm going to plot the density of the resulting samples. And you can see, because I'm doing a million iterations, you can see the progress bar in action there. Okay? So that's what the posterior distribution looks like. I'm now going to fit the model again. The only difference being, I'm going to increase this prior precision tau to 10. So it was 1, it's now 10. Again, I'm going to calculate the density and just add that to my plot. So the black line just appeared there shows that the posterior distribution has shifted, and it shifted towards 0. And the reason for that is because I've got a stronger prior precision. The prior distribution is centered around 0, and as I increase the size of the prior precision, I make the prior dominate over the posterior distribution, over the data, I beg your pardon. Right, let's do that one more time, this time with a tau equals 20. And And this time, the posterior distribution is shifted even closer to zero. So this phenomenon is called shrinkage, and it's a well-known phenomenon in Bayesian inference. If you put a lot of prior information in your model, then you need a lot of data to overcome it. And in this case, in this last case, let me just zoom in on here. Here we're putting such a strong prior on the parameter theta that the true value from our simulated data, which is 3.7, which is up here, that's actually excluded by the posterior. So it really shows that the prior, strong prior is starting to dominate over the posterior. Now there's actually a numerical relationship that explains this, but I'm going to calculate the posterior precision of each of these estimates. It's 1 over the variance. So I'm just going to do those three things. So it goes 51, 59, 69, and that looks suspiciously like a linear relationship, and indeed it is. I'm just going to plot those. Right, let's have a look at this. Zoom. So on the x-axis, we have the tau parameter, the prior precision, for our three models. On the y-axis, we have the posterior distribution. And you can see that there is indeed a linear relationship between the two of them. And that's why I ran this for 1 million samples, so that we could make sure that we were accurately estimating this. It's actually additive. To get the posterior precision, you add the prior precision and the precision of the data. It's 1 over the empirical variance of the data. So that sort of mathematical relationship explains this rather obscure idea of parameterizing the normal distribution in terms of its precision rather than in terms of its variance or its standard deviation. Now, at the time, this made sense because this is the kind of way that the Bayesians thought. We're kind of stuck with it now, even though it's not really very useful, because most people can't really, don't really have an intuitive understanding of what precision means, and most of us think much more easily in terms of the standard deviation. So to be honest, it would be a lot nicer if the normal distribution in bugs was parameterized in terms of its mean and its standard deviation, but that's not actually the case, and we just have to work around that. Are there any questions at this point? Because, you know, you can interrupt me at any moment. All right, well, having introduced... I'm going to skip through the Gibbs sampling because there's a lot of theory there, as you can see. And we go. More on the Bugs language. So having introduced this simple model, I can now talk about the Bugs language. And it's important for you to understand that Bugs is a little bit different from R. And I'm just going to highlight some of the similarities and the differences. So each variable in your model should appear only once on the left-hand side of a relation. But it can appear multiple times on the right-hand side. And there are some variables that only appear on the right-hand side of the relation. In this case, here's one. So this, I should say, this is an example of a binomial model. The binomial distribution parameterized in terms of the probability parameter and the size parameter. So here, for example, the size n is never defined on the left-hand side of a relationship. And that means that n must be supplied with the data. But apart from that, for the variables that are defined on the left-hand side of a relation, these could be either parameters or they could be data. Nothing in the actual bugs model description tells you what is a parameter and what is data. That distinction is made when you supply data, when you fit the model. So if a variable is given a numeric value, then it's data, otherwise it's a parameter. That's actually quite a nice feature, because what it means is that if you have missing values in your data, then you can easily accommodate these in your bugs model. You don't need to change the bugs model. You just supply a missing value, NA, in your data. However, there is an extra level of complexity because this is a Bayesian model. Everything has to have a prior distribution. So if there is a missing value in your data, it must have a prior distribution so that JAX can then sample from its posterior distribution. But otherwise, it's quite a nice feature of the Bugs language that can easily accommodate missing data. So there are for loops. You've noticed already that there are for loops in the Bugs language, and they take this general form for some variable in some sequence, open brackets, and inside you have a set of relations. You can have as many as you like. So this thing, the sequence, it can be any expression that generates an integer vector. Most of the time, we're using this sequence operator 1 colon n, which you're very familiar with from R, and that just generates a sequence, increasing sequence from 1 to n. It must be, this sequence must be something that can be calculated from the data or from numeric constants in the model. It's not allowed to depend on unobserved parameters. Unlike R, curly braces are compulsory. So following a for loop, you must put these curly braces in. And this indexing variable there can be used inside. And I'll just go up here. So here's the indexing variable. And as you can see, we're using the indexing variable I in these relations inside. That's very useful. And the indexing variable, unlike R, the indexing variable is not accessible outside the loop. So once the loop ends, the indexing variable is gone. This is, again, unlike R, where the indexing variable is still available once the loop is finished. However, Bugs is not R. So the design of the Bugs language was influenced by S, the prototype for the R language. But despite the similarity in syntax, they are actually semantically different because R describes operations that change the value of the data. It's a functional language. You can use it in a procedural way as well. Whereas Bugs describes static relations between variables, and that means it's a declarative language. Now, the most well-known example of a declarative language is HTML, Hypertext Markup Language, which describes the contents of a web page. It doesn't describe how to draw it. It just describes the contents. Similarly, the Bugs language describes the model. It describes the relationships between the variables, which are static. They do not change. But it doesn't tell you anything about how you should draw samples from it. So that's the analogy you need to bear in mind. The fact that Bugs is a declarative language does have some important consequences. For example, you can't do this. You can do this in R, but you can't do it in Bugs. Because here you're in R, this is a simple procedural thing. You're saying variable x takes the value 1, and now I've changed my mind, and variable x will take the value 3. That doesn't work in Bugs because it offers two contradictory definitions of the variable x. You can only have one. So a variable can only appear once on the left-hand side of a relationship, and that defines the variable. Now, although for loops exist in the Bugs language, they are not a control structure. Okay, what they are is basically a form of macro expansion. So the way to think about for loops in Bugs is to say, we have this relationship here with this parameter I, and what the for loop does is expand this line where I takes every value in this sequence. So this gets expanded by the model compiler to this. And that's all it does. Right? It's not a control flow statement at all. It's a macro expansion. All right. I think I've covered this already. Although the Bugs language is agnostic about whether random variables are observed, i.e. data, or unobserved parameters, there are some elements of the language that must always be fixed. So indices on the left-hand side of a relation must be fixed, and the sequence argument in a for loop must also be fixed. Plus anything that appears on the right-hand side of a relation without ever being defined on the left. So there's a little bit of ambiguity in the Bugs language, but there are some things that you must definitely supply as data. I'm going to skip over that. So just while I'm talking about the differences between Bugs and R, there is an important difference in the sequence operator. So in R, this expression m colon n, it generates an intersequence from m to n. It's increasing if n is greater than m, it's decreasing if n is less than m, and it's a scalar if both values are equal. Now in bugs, the sequence operator behaves differently when the second value is smaller than the first. It actually generates a vector of length 0. And this is very, very useful in for loops because it means that if n is less than m, and you use this as the indexing vector of a for loop, then the for loop gets skipped. And that's actually useful. It's used in a lot of models. But it's different behavior because R generates a decreasing sequence. And bugs will just basically generate a vector of length 0. So that's important. All right, here's a more complicated model. We've done this very, very simple location model. Here's the first step towards a more realistic model, the kind of thing you might want to actually use JAGS for. So this is a linear regression model, and it's just quite sobering to compare that with how you would fit it in R. So this is not very encouraging, is it? I mean, yes. Well, you can't really debug the bug's code. When you compile your model, it'll either create a graph or it won't. Now, if it doesn't, if something goes wrong, the compiler will give you a message. So it might say you're using this variable in your model, but you haven't defined it. Please define it or supply it as data. There's one. Another one might be there appears to be a directed cycle in your model, which is not allowed. So error messages from the compiler are one of the most important features. And as I've been working on JAGS, I've been trying to improve them. Because as you know, there's nothing worse than an uninformative error message. So although you can't debug it, I try and give an informative message when things go wrong. And obviously, this is one of the things I'm interested in improving as I continue to work on it, because it's the important usability feature. Individual values of the... Yes. Not really. No. It's designed to really be a sort of a black box. You know, you supply the model of the data and turn the handle and something comes out again. If you're interested in that level of detail, there is another software package called Nimble. Nimble also uses the bug's language, but it's written in R. And that means that you've got all the debugging facilities of R are available to you. So, NIMBLE, capitals. It's available from CRAN. Yeah. So, there's bad news and there's good news. I mean, the bad news is that even the simplest non-trivial model in the bug's language is quite verbose. The good news is that once you've gotten over that initial disappointment, really complicated models are not much worse. Okay, so there's no sort of exponential growth in complexity once you've got over the fact that models in bugs tend to be very, very lengthy. But of course, there's a reason for this. I'll just step through the reasons one by one. Okay. Reason number one is that we have to give names to our parameters. So the model fitting software in R is very, very clever. It automatically generates names for the parameters of the model. In the bug's language, that doesn't happen. You have to give names. So here I've given the name alpha to my intercept parameter and beta to my slope parameter. So that's one reason. Secondly, because we're being, there's the data y and x is normally all you need for the linear model, but we also need to give names to the parameters. Because we're Bayesian, all of these parameters need prior distributions. So that automatically makes the model more verbose, because we have to say alpha is not simply an unknown quantity that we have to estimate. Alpha is a random variable, and we have to give a prior distribution to that random variable. Now, unlike R, the language is not vectorized. So it's these statements here, which you could imagine could easily be vectorized, they're not. So when you have repeated structures like this, you have to do them explicitly in for loops rather than writing them down in vectorized form. So again, that makes everything a little bit longer and a little bit more verbose. And finally, the model may include some parameter transformations. So here, for example, is an example where the prior distribution is actually a uniform prior on the log of the standard deviation. And then there are various transformations that are required to turn that into the precision parameter tau that's actually used by the model. That's a particularly complicated transformation. But the point is that you can, it's an important point to get across, you can put a prior distribution on any scale and then transform that scale to the one that's actually needed by the Bugs language. Right. Let me check my schedule. Okay. So the next exercise is the surgical example. This is a very, very simple model. These are real data on mortality rates in 12 hospitals that are performing cardiac surgery in babies. This is obviously a high-risk business, and obviously the risk of mortality very high when there are cardiac malformations. And as you can see, unfortunately, this does happen. So for each hospital, we've got the number of operations performed and the number of deaths that took place. And we can model the number of deaths as a binomial response variable with a failure probability P. So this is the starting point for an investigation of the mortality rates in the hospitals and deciding if some of these hospitals are underperforming in terms of their mortality rate. Does one of these hospitals have a mortality rate that's significantly higher than the others? This is a difficult question to answer, and of course it's a very delicate question to answer, but it's very important to do this kind of monitoring in order to see whether the health service is performing well or not. So it's a serious example, but it's still a relatively simple model. So the next exercise is based on this. But let me just check the time. We are coming up for 11, when we're supposed to take a break. So I will just introduce the exercise, and then we can do it afterwards. So we're going to skip ahead to section 5 of the practicals document. So the data is contained in the file surgicaldata.r. It contains the number of cardiac surgeries, N, and the number of deaths, R, in 12 hospitals. You can source that into R. So before we even think about fitting a Bayesian model to this, you can start asking some simple questions. Which hospital has the lowest death rate? You can calculate the death rate in each hospital. You can find which one is the lowest and which one is the highest. And when we actually fit a Bayesian model to this, it will be quite illuminating to compare that face value assessment with the inference that you get from the Bayesian model. Here's an example. Here's the first model that we're going to fit, which again is very simple. This is a beta binomial model. So the outcome R is represented as a binomial distribution with probability P of mortality, number of surgeries N, and the underlying distribution of P is a beta distribution with two shape parameters, 1 and 1, and that's actually equal to the uniform distribution. You can fit this model in the same way, but there's a nice utility function called readjags.data. If you've got your data in an external file, you can read it in. Unlike the source function, which reads the variables into your global environment, the readjags.data will return a list, and that list can be assigned. So we read the data in, we assign it to the object surgical, and then printing surgical shows that we've got the data, the number of observations, the number of operations, the number of deaths. And then you can fit that in the same way that fitted the other one. Some burn-in, I'll explain what burn-in is later, but you need to run the model a little bit before you start collecting samples. And then we collect samples on P. So that's how to do it in RJAGS. I'm also going to give a demonstration of how to do that in various other packages as well, because the RJAGS package is not the only package that you can use to interface R to JAGS. Other people have been working on different interfaces, which have some important strengths compared with the raw low-level interface of the RJAGS package. And in this exercise, we're going to spend a little bit of time inspecting what this object is that we get out of the model. Okay, so after we come back from the break, I'd like you to get as far as the end of 5.1. I'll give you that should be relatively easy to do. But we should probably break for coffee now. We'll start again at 11:30.